Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This installment is mostly a personal essay. It's a meditation on motorcycles and motorcycling, and on trying to escape from corporate plastic and searching for authenticity. Sure, I'm just rewriting Catcher in the Rye, only this time Holden Caulfield is in his early 60s and he's riding a Harley Road King. I hope you'll stay tuned. At my age, I find I have a couple fewer vices than I used to. I don't drink anymore, don't gamble, never smoked, and apparently Connecticut always had a severe scarcity of loose women, especially in my neighborhood. How I miss Pittsburgh in the 1970s. I have sloth, of course, but I don't even know if sloth is considered a vice. Maybe it's just one of the seven deadly sins. I don't know. I wasn't brought up a Catholic. The Methodist Church didn't have deadly sins back then, though I believe they did practice all the vices religiously. One vice I do have is burning more gasoline than necessary. I've owned one motorcycle or another for 40 years. Sure, I commute to work on my motorcycle more often than not, but I also ride it a lot for psychotherapy or just for pleasure. It would be more responsible to ride my bicycle instead, and better for my cholesterol, to say nothing of the ozone layer. Well, at least I do feel guilty about all the unnecessary internal combustion I'm setting off. Now, motorcycling leads me to a lot of thoughts about the genuine and the fake, about human values versus corporate values, and about authenticity versus plastic. I like the concept plastic in its late 1960s sense of phony, fake, artificial in the worst sense of the word. Like the old song by the Mothers of Invention, "Plastic People." There's almost a glut of highly verbal motorcyclists expressing similar thoughts. Robert M. Pirsig went down this path before I did. He wrote a surprisingly popular book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Remember that? Came out in 1974, and I think it's still in print. In that book, Pirsig spent a lot of time and words reflecting on the nature of quality with a capital Q. I never did figure out exactly what his meaning was here. He had done graduate work at the University of Chicago, and it showed. But my sense is that he was definitely on the right track. His search for capital Q quality was much like my search for authenticity. Both terms are opposites of plastic. And both his search and mine involved riding around on a motorcycle. And before that, there was Holden Caulfield, sick and tired of phoniness. Probably The Catcher in the Rye would be a better book if Holden had bought a motorcycle. His mother would never have let him, of course. Nor would my mother. To her dying day, Mom hoped I would get rid of the motorcycle before I killed myself. I might prove her right someday. Mom was a generous and loving woman. If I do prove her right someday and kill myself on a motorcycle, I'm sure she will have the grace not to say, "I told you so." A lot of motorcycles today are extremely complex machines, and they look it. They have complicated computer control of engine parameters, moment-by-moment automatic suspension adjustment, traction control, anti-lock brakes, GPS, Sirius satellite radio, and Bluetooth everything, with looks to match. Odd, cluttered, asymmetrical shapes with weird edges and intersections. Intrusive, unusual shapes for everything. They looked like some Rube Goldberg contraption that's been run through a trash compactor. I've always been attracted to simpler design, simple, clean lines, and the minimum of bells and whistles. For the past 13 years, I've had the same motorcycle, a Harley-Davidson model called the Road King. This is an old-fashioned-looking Harley. Looks like an Electroglide police bike from 1965. Big, clear windshield in front, fiberglass saddlebags in back. Air-cooled V-twin engine. No tachometer needed, just a big round speedometer on top of the gas tank. My machine even has a carburetor. No fancy fuel injection for the likes of me. I think I got the last one. Not even Harley uses carburetors anymore. Harley-Davidson Motor Company spent a huge amount of time and money in making this antiquated motorcycle design work well by today's standards. And it does work well. It's been very reliable, apart from one breakdown at age 12, and it has never leaked a drop of oil. When it comes to top speed or acceleration or pure horsepower, many motorcycles will top the Road King. But the Road King has a certain elegance of form and function, an elegance that's hard to explain. It's got enough power, and it's quiet. The self-canceling turn signals work very well. That's actually very hard to design for a motorcycle. The clutch engages beautifully. The carburation is excellent. No stumbles or lurches at any throttle opening. The gearbox shifts loudly but precisely. The saddlebags are large and quite waterproof. The gas mileage is fairly decent, 40 miles per gallon on the blue highways, less on the interstate. The saddle is comfortable for hours at a time. Add a passenger and the bike still handles well. The big headlight and spotlights light up the road very nicely. Even in cold weather, the big engine starts right up. The bike is heavy, but it's not top heavy. The weight is carried fairly low. And everywhere, the Road King's lines are clean, simple, and mostly organic. If you just drive a car, you might take all these virtues for granted, but finding all of them in a motorcycle is rare. The bike's quiet virtues are Harley-Davidson's dark secrets. The company's overactive marketing department has never said a word about any of the bike's real virtues. Marketing prefers to spin fantasies about rugged individualism and lifestyle and hipness and thunder and machismo and the high-tech gewgaws on a few top-of-the-line models, not the Road King, fortunately. Gewgaws like the multimedia infotainment system with its 6-inch color display on the dashboard. Thanks, but no thanks. I'll keep the good saddlebags and the good headlight and the motor that starts right up on winter mornings, though. New England's back roads and small towns are all the infotainment system I need. Plus, maybe a good road atlas staying nice and dry in the right saddlebag. I don't want to endorse any particular brand of motorcycle. You could also buy a very nice Honda motorcycle, or BMW, or Triumph, or Kawasaki. And now they've even resurrected Indian. Indian was a grand American brand a century ago. They were made just upstream from me in Springfield, Massachusetts. Indian was Harley-Davidson's chief competitor until the 1950s, when Indian went out of business. Since then, a couple failed attempts were made to revive the brand, but the current attempt looks like it's working. Polaris, the jet ski and snowmobile people. Polaris owns Indian now, so the owners have some capital and some good engineers on the payroll, and even some experience making motorcycles. I wish them well. Interestingly, I haven't heard any complaints about racist brand names with Indian. To my ears, Indian Motorcycles doesn't sound a whole lot different from Washington Redskins. and the company is rubbing it on thick, resurrecting also its old model names like Chief and Scout. At least the new company isn't calling its factory the Wigwam. The original company did. That's what they called the Springfield Works, the Wigwam. Sheesh. Actually, I don't mean to talk about motorcycles all day. That's just a preface. I mean to talk about authenticity. But if you're out looking for authenticity, a motorcycle is as good a vehicle as any to search for it. And a Harley Road King isn't a bad choice. Other vehicles could work. Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters used an old school bus. William Least Heat Moon used a van. That was in his book Blue Highways. On a Rand McNally map, the blue highways are the back roads, the numbered state routes. That's what you want to drive down. Me too. And then there was Simon and Garfunkel's song America. Here, the narrator and his girlfriend set out on a Greyhound bus. Do you remember that song, America? There's one line in it that makes me want to cry every time I hear it. It's done this, like, for 30 years. I don't even know why. It goes, Kathy, I'm lost, I said, though I knew she was sleeping.
I'm empty and aching and I don't know why. Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come to look for a
Why that line always chokes me up is one of life's little mysteries. Beats me. Probably because I felt the same. Lost and empty and aching and I don't know why. I once even had a girlfriend named Kathy. I may even have boarded a Greyhound in Pittsburgh. That was another line from the song. But I digress. Anyway, for them it was a Greyhound bus. For me, as for Robert Pirsig, a motorcycle. For Wyatt and Billy in the film Easy Rider, it was a motorcycle. And for many others, too, it was a motorcycle. A lot of pop music involves motorcycles. Sometimes it's a means of escape, as in Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run. Sometimes it's a means of rebellion, as in Steppenwolf's Born to Be Wild. Or maybe it's just for pleasure, as in Arlo Guthrie's motorcycle song. We won't even mention the Shangri-La's Leader of the Pack.
He's sort of small. He kissed me goodbye. The tears were beginning to show. As he drove away on that rainy night, I begged him to go slow. And what he heard, I'll never know.
But once in a while, in music, it's a quest like mine. Get away from the fake and the plastic. Get away from fashion and the mind games played by the sophisticates. Get out into the country. Get in touch with a lifestyle older and smaller and slower and more personal. Someplace where you don't have to carry a smartphone or an infotainment center to feel connected. Is life in the provinces more authentic than it is in the suburbs? Hard to say, but it looks like it to an outsider. For sure, life in the provinces is less corporate controlled, at least on the surface. Of course, the corporation still owns the factory where everybody works and which they're in the process of shutting down. But the local culture is less run by and for corporate marketing departments. Downtown is not just a commercial strip choked with franchises accessible only by car. Even as hip and urban a guy as Lou Reed sang about firing up his Kawasaki GPZ, getting the heck out of town, and putting the kickstand down in rural Pennsylvania. That's in his song New Sensations, released in 1984. That's just a couple of years after William Least Heat Moon published his tale of traveling the blue highways. Back then, I myself didn't have to escape to anywhere. I was already there in eastern Iowa. But now I understand what he's saying. Here's a bit of Lou Reed.
I took my GPZ out for a ride. The engine felt good between my thighs. The air felt cool, it was 40 degrees outside. I rode to Pennsylvania near the Delaware Gap. Sometimes I got lost and had to check the map. I stopped at a roadside diner for a burger and a Coke. There were some country folk and some hunters inside. Somebody got themselves married and somebody died. I went to the jukebox and played a hillbilly song. They was arguing about football as I weaved and went outside. And I headed for the mountains feeling warm inside. I love that GPZ so much, you know, that I could kiss her. Sensations. Ooh, 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 new sensations.
I thought of Lou Reed's song as I was riding the motorcycle home just last Friday. I had had reason to ride to the town of Montville in southeastern Connecticut. Not a very good reason, but there I was. When I finished my business there, I was hungry. After some internal debate, I stopped at a somewhat grungy-looking little diner I had noticed on the edge of town. Mel's Diner, on a genuine blue highway, Connecticut Route 163. 163 here was an urban street in a small, old mill town. Exactly what mill town this particular spot was is a matter of discussion. Between the cook's explanation and later Wikipedia, I think I figured it out. You could play it safe and say the diner is in Montville. Montville covers a lot of ground, including the spot where the diner stands. Most people, though, would say Uncasville. That's the name the post office uses. Technically, Uncasville is a village within the town of Montville. However, the diner probably is actually in Palmertown, which is a different village within the town of Montville. Palmertown is where the map says we are. However, the term Palmertown is no longer in common use, except among some old people, the cook told me. So why don't you just say Uncasville? Logically, Uncasville is the least correct of the three possible names, but that's the best one to use if you actually want people to understand where you're talking about. I guess I've been living in New England too long, because this all made perfect sense. 30 years ago, I would have thought I had taken a wrong turn off Route 82 and ended up in the Twilight Zone. But by now, it all seemed perfectly sensible. I don't claim to understand the Christian doctrine of the Trinity, but a lot of people around here at least claim to believe it. And if the Trinity is at least partly comprehensible to you, it should be just a snap to believe that Mel's Diner is in Montville, and Uncasville, and Palmertown. The Mohegan Indians have a resort casino in the area, which they too say is in Uncasville, even though the casino is even further away from Uncasville than Mel's Diner is. There's just something magical about that name that makes everyone want to say they live there. Uncasville. Of course, the Mohegans have an excuse. After all, Uncasville was named after one of their own. We'll see if any of the Mohegans decides to open up a dealership selling Indian motorcycles. I'm guessing they won't. But in the unlikely event they do, they'll probably put it in New London and say it's in Uncasville. But I digress. Back to Mel's Diner. Very small place, and as unpretentious as you can get. On the outside, it looks just a little shabby. Old asphalt shingles, and parking for just 6 cars right in front. No stainless steel, no neon, except for a small sign in a window that says, "Open." Inside, you find just 6 booths and 5 small tables and 8 stools at the counter. But inside is very clean, well-lighted, and comfortable. Copies of the local newspaper are on the counter. A staff of 2 today, a waitress and a cook, both women about 40. No cutesy professional patter cooked up by some marketing department from either of them. The waitress didn't tell me her name and didn't ask how I am doing today. That's a good sign. Cordial enough and genuine. Just a normal, decent 40-year-old woman. Not an actress with a script to recite. The cook was more the tugboat Annie type, but also cordial. I liked them both. A young Asian family was in one booth, a teenaged couple in another. 2 workmen and I shared the counter. On one end of the room was a big corrugated box that said Christmas decorations. Hand-lettered in magic marker. Terrific. I parked my helmet, jacket, and gloves on top. The breakfast menu was small and the lunch menu smaller. My cheeseburger was large and surprisingly good. Freshly ground, the waitress said. The owner insists on it. The owner is not a corporation, but a local person, needless to say. The coffee was very good, too, much better than the usual restaurant stuff. The bill came to less than $8. A good deal. Why did I find this place so attractive? It wasn't the food, really. Certainly not the decor. Certainly not the prestige of the place, or the trendiness, or the glamour of the staff. There was just something real about the place. Real food prepared and served by real people. To customers who also are real people. All of them part of a real community, not just transients off a highway off-ramp. Mel's seemed to be part of the daily life of an actual town, even if the townsmen didn't quite agree on what the name of the town was. All part of a real town, except for me, that is. I was the transient, the interloper, though they treated me well nonetheless. The place just felt real in a way that cookie-cutter franchises never do. There must be 8,000 Dunkin' Donuts restaurant franchises in Connecticut, all identical. At least all identical in my memory. All of them seem to have the same faceless staff, the same mediocre food, the same yellow plastic bilingual caution wet floor sign, the same dull commercial strip for a neighborhood, the same menu, every item on it focus group tested and computer controlled. Never a surprise, never an unexpected delight, never a big cardboard box that says Christmas decorations at the end of the room. I have some acquaintances who motorcycle. These particular people wouldn't dream of stopping any place but Dunkin' Donuts to take a break. Maybe McDonald's, in the unlikely event there's no Dunkin' Donuts nearby. Mel's Diner would be out of the question. Too small, too archaic, not efficient enough, not enough flavors available, bathroom too small, and the waitress isn't 17 and perky and cute. Of course, these motorcyclists don't care much for Harley-Davidsons either, and for some of the same reasons. Well, it takes all kinds. There's some new construction in my town, Manchester, just north of the downtown center. A used car lot has been demolished, and in its place, they're building a new gas station convenience store, a Cumberland Farms franchise. Regardless of its bucolic name, Cumberland Farms is owned by a big oil company. Of course. The sloping roof of the new store has some nice New England-style gables, or you might call them dormer windows. Like a Cape Cod-style house has on its second floor, jutting out of its sloping roof. I saw the construction of the new store. First, they put on the sloping roof, with no gables. Then they nailed the gable on to the outside of the roof. No connection to the inside. The dormer window doesn't let any light into the building. On the other side of the window, there's nothing but the solid outside of the roof. Now, here in New England, we like windows. And we have this quaint belief that the purpose of a window is to let light into the inside of a building. Don't ask me how that belief got started. New Englanders used to believe in a lot of odd things, including slavery and killing Indians and witches. But some of the old beliefs made a certain sense, like hamburger should be fresh, and if you want a girly show, go to a burlesque hall, not a restaurant, and windows should have some connection to illuminating the inside of a building. Then there's the new branch of a bank they just built in downtown East Hartford. On the roof of this new little one-story frame building, they put a fake widow's walk. Now, in an old house overlooking the sea, in an old New England seacoast town, you might find a so-called widow's walk. It's a flat platform surrounded by a railing at the very top of the roof. The sea captain's wife could get there through a trap door and gaze out to sea, searching for her husband's ship. Maybe she's praying for his safe return. Maybe she wants to be sure he's well out to sea before she meets her lover. I don't know. That's up to her. But a widow's walk wasn't just decoration. It had a function for human beings. Sort of like a window. But here's a new one-story bank building in the heart of downtown East Hartford. And from the bank's widow's walk, a captain's wife could gaze out at the ugly three-story buildings surrounding it. You couldn't possibly catch a glimpse of the sea, or even the Connecticut River a half a mile away. At best, from the widow's walk, you'd have a nice view of the cars driving up and down Main Street. And maybe you'd see a dark red 2002 Road King glide by, heading for the Charter Oak Bridge, heading out of town, heading towards Uncasville, or Tariffville, or Hebron, or Heartland, maybe even exceeding the speed limit, feeling empty and aching and I don't know why, trying to leave behind what Gene Shepherd called creeping meatballism, and what Frank Zappa called plastic. Searching for a world where the hamburger is fresh, and the windows let in light, and the widow's walks have a view of the sea, and the waitress doesn't ask, "How am I doing today?" And when I find this El Dorado, I'm going to put down my kickstand and turn off the ignition and recharge my batteries. This is Kenneth Doust. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimae non carborundum, and please come back again next week. Ciao.